Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England.
Hi, George. Lovely to talk to you again. Lovely to talk to Texas, the home of William Cooper and all sorts of fascinating people that have really got to the bottom of some of the crazy stuff that's going on in our society today and how we've managed to end up with our mainstream media churning out lies day after day, week after week, with a bunch of zombie morons calling themselves editors trying to control these stations and managers, with the journalists just doing what they can to get the truth out to us and finding themselves stood on, stamped on the whole time.
Right. You've been broadcasting for a while now. Tell our listening audience a little bit about you first.
I started in the aviation business, George, back in the late 1980s, got into the BBC in the 1990s and did 3 to 4 years, mostly in London, doing really what was, I suppose, cutting edge in the biggest newsroom the BBC had for their London BBC network, which was a newsroom of something like 20 staff, producers, and a lot of journalists. So when there was a big story in London, the news editor, who's a very young, dynamic guy by the name of James Cameron, he used to send out sometimes 3 or 4 staff to the same story if it was quite a big story. And it's quite a luxury nowadays, even for many editors, to be able to send people to the scene of a story. Sometimes they're trying to work now from behind a desk in the office, and they hardly ever get out to a story. But he was able to send several people to it. And this is, we're talking about in the early 1990s, which was the time of the IRA bombing campaign in London. So I was working on a lot of those stories and working largely on getting people who were members of the public, who were on the scene of stories, and getting them talking straight to the whole of London, which to me was great fun. And it was a way of, first of all, bypassing some of the self-censorship that you get from some journalists who are worried about their jobs, with getting just ordinary members of the public who are articulate to talk to the city, to really give them the latest on whatever the news story of the day was. And, of course, like I said, IRA bombs were going off here, there and everywhere, and there was a lot to do, and that's where I started. And I'm now doing land rights campaigning, that is, land occupations, really trying to liberate the land from the big landowners who seem to then do nothing with it, to try and redistribute land a little bit here in Britain. And now I'm doing my own radio program here in Bristol, and I've got a column on RT, and I do on Russia Today. I do quite often pieces on them on cyber security and a lot of the Edward Snowden stuff, for example, because I've been scrutinizing the scrutinizers for many years on my blog, bilderberg.org, and I'm known as a bit of an expert on that because I spent several years, also in the mid-1990s, literally years, going through the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which is one of the oldest libraries in the English-speaking world, trawling it for information about these Bilderbergs, because I could see there was a serious problem back in the 1950s, 10 years after the Battle of Arnhem, where Bilderbergers were involved in sabotaging the excellent plan by Monty to finish the war early. Carrington and Bernhard both involved in sabotaging that plan. And then 10 years later, the Bilderberg conferences started in the same spot, the Witch's Cauldron, where the British troops were massacred at Arnhem. So I've been looking into that and all of the fascinating stuff right at the very beginning of the Bilderbergs, how it was formed by the Council on Foreign Relations, the War and Peace Studies groups in World War II, 1943, actually. The idea of Bilderberg was first put together and then implemented after the war by people like Alan Dulles with CIA money. A lot of the people involved were former Nazis or people who had helped Nazis escape justice. And so this was obviously something which was a bit of a worry, you know. If you're going to win the war, you've got to actually finish the organization that started it, the fascist cult, the Nazis, were living on very successfully with Martin Bormann, etc. So that's me in a nutshell, and that's why I'm, you know, doing what I'm doing now, because I see our struggle really as one which is against fascism here in the West, with NATO being formed, as Paul Hauser, who's an SS general, said, from the international battalions of supporters of the SS. NATO was first formed, and that's Hauser himself. He was on the Eastern Front. He was in charge of a Panzer Corps, of Hitler's Panzer Corps, Hauser was, and he also ran something called HIAG, H-I-A-G, which was the veterans network for the Waffen-SS well after the war, and he was freed early as well from prison. So there are a whole bunch of people involved in the Bilderberg network, the post-war Nazi network, who I think we need to nail, because the job wasn't finished properly.
Yeah, well, this is important because the Ukraine has all kinds of factions that you could designate as Nazi-oriented.
That's absolutely right, because one of the first things when I saw all this stuff kicking off in Ukraine, I mean, I must admit I wasn't entirely surprised by it, rather, you know, this is the pattern of Western regime change now, NATO regime change. They like to appear to be standing off, but they've got their friends and agents, their Gladio agents, Operation Gladio. I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with. Do look it up if you're not. But that's NATO's fascist killings during the last 30, 40 years right across Europe. That was exactly what was going on over in Ukraine. But the thing that shocked me, George, was I had an inkling in my mind that I'd seen something from a couple of years ago about Ukraine, about neo-Nazis there, and I looked it up, and sure enough, there's a really interesting story about war veterans who had been remembering the Second World War. I think it was something like 65 years since the end of it, or something, an anniversary like that of some sort, where hundreds of war veterans, many in their 80s, octogenarians, had come with their war medals, and they were having a silent Christian service at a war memorial. I believe it was in Kiev, or possibly in western Ukraine somewhere. And you know what? That entire service was actually had to be ended, because there were a whole load of neo-Nazi thugs turned up. These are teenagers, some of them, in their 20s, with Nazi emblems and their own party emblems from Ukraine. And they started pelting these octogenarians with half bricks, if you can believe it. I mean, that was a story from a couple of years ago. So you can see that there's this really, literally, very much pro-Nazi. I'm not talking about just far-right, pro-Nazi sentiment, you know, pro-Hitler sentiment in Ukraine. And this has been a tension underlying that country, really, ever since the days of Perestroika.
Well, you know, then you have the neocons in there operating through regime change, and the neoliberalism liberals, you know, in there also, and they're coming from this Martin Bormann group of Argentina by way of the U.S. You know what I mean? Resurgence of a Nazism. So it's fascism. All these are fascist elements fighting each other, are they not, or helping support each other?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they're basically used. As you'll see, if anyone has studied the Gladio, the fascist elements are used by the official NATO intelligence people in Brussels and others who coordinated. A lot of them are former intelligence people, retired intelligence people. They have very formalized networks, though, several of which, you know, your listeners can find. I mean, as the Pinay Circle is one of them, for example. These formalized intelligence networks of retired intelligence people who are very much right-leaning. And, of course, they get into those jobs and they feel that kind of sense of adrenaline, the sense of power. And when they retire, they want to hang on to it. They don't want to let go of that. And, of course, that translates into a completely undemocratic network and a way of manipulating events from behind the scenes. And, you know, I mentioned right at the start, George, that I was involved in aviation and general aviation here in Britain, where I worked at Biggin Hill, which was one of the fighter airports during the Second World War, fighter bases, which was protecting London from the Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain. I worked down there for several years in a family business. And when I saw all this stuff to do with the MH370 Malaysian Airlines, immediately ringing alarm bells for me. I mean, I've been blogging about it, writing about it on our forum, which is 911forum.org.uk. I'm having a really good discussion there with other people who are members of that forum from all parts of the world, sharing information. I mean, it was very interesting to see that the entire story was blown out of the water literally in the first week by Rolls-Royce, who are based here in Bristol, explaining that the aircraft actually flew on for 5 miles. Now, I don't know about you, George, but I don't know any aircraft that have trouble in their flight. They turn around and then they fly on for 5 hours and then they crash. Have you ever heard of that before?
Why not, really? So what is going on this, Tony? It's a mystery.
I don't think it's much of a mystery. I mean, we seem to be pointed towards the idea that this plane may have landed at Diego Garcia. It was certainly heading off in that direction and had enough fuel, it seems, to get there. But I would suggest it's definitely landed somewhere. Quite what's happening to the passengers, God only knows.
But there's another very important aspect to this,
which is very similar in a way and gives a signature that this is a put-up job, that this is definitely some kind of false flag operation, an intelligence operation aimed potentially at the Chinese or the Malaysians or both. But that's the sightings in the Maldives last week. Now, that was, I think, Wednesday morning. We got reports from Maldives newspapers, ordinary printed newspapers, then translated onto the web from the Maldives, which is the islands in between India and Diego Garcia, that there were half a dozen people, including school teachers, etc., that had sighted this aircraft at 6:30 in the morning on the Sunday after it was lost on the Saturday night. It definitely identified as the same aircraft, the same livery. These guys are saying it's so low that they could see the doors in the aircraft. Now, hang on a minute. You know what that tells me? That tells me that aircraft's been flying under the radar. I would also suggest that the most likely scenario there is that somebody has come through to the pilot from the military. I mean, knowing the way that civil aviation works, if the military comes through to you on the radio, whatever reason, it may not have been on a frequency that could be heard by air traffic control, and they tell you, no, you're not going to overfly Vietnam, they may have said, Vietnam airspace is prohibited, they will then steer that aircraft via another frequency, maybe that nobody was actually happened to be listening to, especially if the military asked the plane to switch frequencies, and that plane could then be very easily and in an unflapped way be steered by the military to go somewhere else. Now, obviously it's heading in the direction of Diego Garcia somewhere, if it's been sighted by these people from the Maldives. Now, the reason I say this is because both with the Rolls-Royce angle on that story and the Maldives angle, what we got was an avalanche of denials after both stories. In fact, they even managed to get Rolls-Royce to deny what they'd said. And that tells me what you've got is a psychological operation, information operations units, working on the press through the military, through the media, in the national governments of the various countries, even possibly China, certainly America and Britain, and the Malaysians, to deny. Now, when you see that, where these people can't possibly know whether these people in the Maldives saw the plane or whether Rolls-Royce have got it right, you know for sure that this is a news management operation. This is not news we're being told. This is news management, and that is what's seems to be tested here with this MH370 story. Is to what extent can we actually really control the way this news spreads around the world? And I think they've done an incredibly frighteningly good job in just making sure the public are lied to. And that is why the families have been so angry, George, why they've been actually now suing Malaysian Airlines, the Malaysian government, for misinformation and disinformation. It's an appalling way to treat those who have been probably bereaved here.
Right. Two questions for you. What was the Rolls-Royce angle on this? And then I'll do a follow-up
question. Well, Rolls-Royce has said that the plane flew on for 5 hours. That's an absolutely key bit of information, although it was initially denied even by Rolls-Royce. It's quite clear that this is something that whoever has done this, because it clearly seems to me to be a put-up job of some sort, it's not just an ordinary accident of some kind or a crash, that there has been news management going on there. Rolls-Royce have just simply said what they know. It may be that the data that was going between the Rolls-Royce Trent engines, the two engines on this 777, and Rolls-Royce headquarters here in Bristol, wasn't known about by whoever was doing the hijacking. There is another big possibility, of course, other than the military diverting the plane, and that, of course, is cyber hijacking. This is something that's been looked at by a very few people, but is, in fact, I think one of the biggest possibilities here, that you've got a guy in Amsterdam last April, a story we reported on the radio here in Bristol, who's used his Android smartphone to hack into the bus, computer bus, that is the main computer lines in the aircraft, that enabled him to control the control services, the ailerons, the flaps, the wings of the aircraft being controlled from an Android smartphone. There being no proper real security on there. And this was shown to the world, if the world was listening, last April in an Amsterdam conference. So that, I think, is the other possibility. Either the military got on the radio, got the pilot to switch frequencies and told him where to go, and also to go very low, obviously, to avoid a radar. For example, Indian radar wouldn't have been able to pick him up. You know, none of the other radar would, because he was flying incredibly low. Or else the entire plane was just taken over by remote control as a cyber hijacking, rather like many people believe happened on the 9/11 attacks back in 2001.
Yeah, Lyndon LaRouche last night on a talk show that was aired nationally said that he believed that it went into the Asian continent.
No, I doubt it. No, it did not go. This Maldives sighting is very important.
Is that more credible?
The way that it was denied immediately, and the way it seems to have come from just ordinary islanders who heard this really loud noise in the morning, looked up, some of them woke up, they looked out of their windows. It has a ring of truth to me as a genuine sighting. And particularly when these sorts of things are immediately denied by people who can't possibly know anything about whether they saw an airliner or not, that rings alarm bells for me as a news person, that this is a clear sign that news management's going on. So the idea is to squash that story. And of course, you know, within literally an hour of that story coming out, if you were to do an internet search on the Maldives, all you would find would be 25 different denials of the story. You wouldn't find any. You wouldn't actually find the original story at all. It would be completely swamped by denials. And that is exactly how the PSYOPs and the news management works nowadays, George, is you swamp the internet with denials, and then hopefully that story will die. And it did. It never made it onto the news headlines here. It was just briefly on the national broadcasting networks for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half during the morning, and then it was absolutely squashed flat dead by the PSYOPs people.
You know, what I see in the Ukraine now, and see what you think, I want your comments on this. Putin's drawn a line. He's not going to let them take Ukraine.
Well, he has let them take Ukraine, but not Crimea.
Yeah.
This is one of the other reasons that I think there's something going on here, because it's all the same time as all this Crimea business, George, is that the Chinese abstained at the United Nations Security Council over Crimea. Now, there was a lot of pressure on the Chinese, financially and otherwise, from the West, from NATO, to vote with the US and the NATO countries on that issue. The Chinese were absolutely adamant. They don't want to get involved. We're going to take one step back from this Crimea business, and we're going to abstain from the vote. Now, I think that was something which what was happening was the West was very much trying to isolate Russia at the UN Security Council, and the Chinese took away that possibility. They stopped a vote being taken unanimously against the Russian position on Crimea because the Chinese had abstained. Now, I think that this hijacking of the aircraft was a sort of subtle psychological signal to the Chinese Politburo, look what we can do, don't mess with us. And of course, it's not obvious, this is how these psychological attacks work. The idea is to unnerve and disturb the Chinese leadership into thinking, well, hang on a minute, gosh, that may be that they've just killed all those people of ours, and they may be dead, and we may be just, that's just because we didn't vote with them on the Security Council. Now, this is a very subtle way of getting to those individuals in China, potentially. So I think that's a real possibility that the Crimea decision and the cyber hijacking or whatever it is of this Malaysian aircraft could well be related, because you can imagine what would be going on in China now over Crimea. The Russians, in a way, are just saying, well, look, actually what's happened is you're kind of isolated over Crimea. But I think that there is a control freakery in the Western military which does everything it can to have psychological attacks on anybody that crosses them. And, you know, let's face it, if this was a cyber hijack, then the Chinese might be considering the idea that hijack was an act of war against them. And that is a very serious possibility, I think, you know, consideration here, that, you know, that the Chinese will be considering carefully, slowly, unlike the way we do, you know, but this is the potential here, is to actually ramp up. We can see very obviously in the Middle East right now, the Turkish Erdogan banning YouTube, because YouTube have got a clip on of him saying that he wants to attack his own people in order to get a war going with Syria. Now, just a minute, this is not a good time for him to be saying this in the run-up to an election. There is clearly a big attempt by the West at the moment to have provoke a war this spring. And whether that be connected with China in Crimea, because, of course, Crimea is connected very much with Syria and the Middle East, you know, the Black Sea fleet bank, which stopped a war, virtually. I mean, certainly, possibly stopped a war last summer being based in Crimea, George. So a lot of these things are connected. You know, Syria last summer, the information is coming out now that the Ghouta attacks were almost certainly by the rebels, not against the rebels and not by the Assad regime. And the attack on the airliner, the moves in Kiev to take over Ukraine with neo-Nazis are actually reactions to what was going on last summer and the success that the Russians and the Chinese and others had in keeping the peace in the Middle East, which NATO, these gung-ho lunatic war lunatics who have inherited the mantle of Hitler through Paul Hauser and NATO, the origins of NATO, that they are actually now getting to the stage where they're desperate for war to divert attention away from the nightmare economic situation they've created in Europe and the United States. The other thing is this very important at the moment is this transatlantic trade deal, the TTIP. I'm not sure if you've come across that, George, and you've been covering that, because it looks to me, as a very good article by...
Oh, to
trade and... Investment Partnership, I believe it stands for. But it's a big, big...
Okay, well, the Trans-Pacific,
big, important thing. And George Monbiot's been writing about it in The Guardian. Okay. Your listeners might want to read some of that. I mean, he's very close to the Conservative Party, and I suppose what you would call, general right-wing interests in Britain. And because his father was the deputy chairman of the Tory party, Monbiot's father was. But this agreement is basically, the idea is to seal together the EU and the US, the two big United States of Europe and United States of America, and this one giant, like, Babylonian system where there is a kind of illusion of democracy in America, an illusion of democracy, a very even thinner one, in the EU, because, of course, none of that, there's very little elected there. If you look at, for example, LEAP 2020, L-E-A-P, 2020, LEAP 2020 is a French economic think tank that's saying, well, look, all this stuff in Ukraine, they say to us, it's obvious. What they're trying to do is bounce the Europeans into signing this trade deal with the US, which would effectively, through legal mechanisms, make the United States and the European individual states completely powerless to stop the big corporations from taking them to court. If they try and pass a law which affects the profitability of these massive corporations, then the corporations can take the governments to court and sue them. That's what's enshrined in this agreement. So it's a kind of giant Babylonian agreement, George. We need to, I think, warn people not to...
Yeah, right.
We want cooperation, of course we do, between the US and the European ordinary people. Of course we do. But the idea that we're selling our sovereignty in the United States and in Europe to the most powerful corporations on the planet, led by the sort of Bilderbergers, the oil companies, the banking corporations who have fleeced us for all we've got. The one positive thing I'd say about all this is it's very interesting to see Venice and various other people in Catalonia and Spain looking at secession. Because what's happening, this is actually a factor in Crimea too. The Crimeans were very annoyed because they kept paying loads of taxes to Kiev and they weren't seeing anything back from it. And, that's what's happening right across Europe with the loan shark Goldman Sachs banking, IMF and European Central Bank loans, is that everybody is paying loads and loads in taxes, but they're not seeing anything for it. What they're seeing is their infrastructure crumbling and their jobs markets falling to pieces. So they're saying, well, let's secede. And this is what Venice voted for last week. 90% majority of Venetians said, we don't want anything to do with Italy or Rome anymore. We're going to become a city-state like we were for hundreds of years. And I think this is a very interesting reaction that's going on in Europe, looking at it in Catalonia and other places too, to secede, like Crimea has done from the EU. It's just said, no, we're not having anything to do with the EU. We want to run our own affairs because we can't see any benefit in being part of something bigger. We're paying all this money in taxes, but we're seeing nothing in return. And that's what happens when the loan sharks have turned the screws up, the ratchet up too far, is people start to kick back as the Venetians have done. I think we're going to be seeing more of that across Europe the rest of this year. If we can manage to get through the year without NATO creating a false flag attack somewhere in Syria or Germany or God knows where and getting their war started they're so clearly gagging for.
Yeah, one thing that just came out today is that there were five banks that didn't pass the stress test. Federal Reserve stress test was failed by Citigroup, Royal Bank of Scotland Group, the U.S. Units, HSBC Holdings, the U.S. units, Banco Santander, the U.S. units, and then also Zions
Bank
Corporation.
Well, listen, George, they're teetering on the brink, so they want a war. And you know what will happen is there'll be a crash, and they'll blame it on the war. They won't blame it on the banks. That's exactly what seems to be going on, is that they're desperate to find somebody to take the blame when the crash comes. It may be this year. It may well be. And when it does come, they want to make sure that the blame is pointing at China, Russia, elsewhere, and not at them, because it's their crash, and they're worried that there'll be a backlash afterwards. They're always looking to try and divert the blame and scapegoat people for their own errors. In fact, their own, I mean, we had the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, didn't we, getting together last year, which has been going on for a while now, but they are ready and willing to take up all those distressed assets and make a fortune out of the war and the crash, and they're sitting there ready and waiting, licking their lips, waiting for it to happen, George.
Now, there was a little proviso or an added notation on their report. It says the Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated met minimum capital requirements after submitting minimum capital requirements after submitting adjusted capital actions. So actually, the Goldman Sachs initially failed the stress test and had to submit adjusted capital actions to be approved by this, to be outside the stress test.
Well, they bribe their way out of everything.
They bribe their way out of everything.
And, of course, they've used the bailout money to do that, George, haven't they? You know, the money we've used to keep them surviving, they've used to then lobby for their own personal vested interest. One thing I will say is people can tune into our radio show online here. It's www.thisweek.org.uk, thisweek.org.uk, and you can hear that either live or podcasts of it. Of the shows we've been doing. And the first hour we always do a local politician of some sort, an MP or whatever. And the second hour we float the boat out. We do some investigations into big international stories. Last week, for example, we talked to Occupy London about the hollowing out of our democracy and exactly how and why it's happening. And it's really good to see that, you know, although it doesn't get reported at all by the mainstream media, Occupy London is alive and well and actually doing a lot of think tank style work about, you know, what we're going to do once the crash comes and coming up with solutions so they're ready to go. Even if the Treasury isn't working on that sort of thing, there's a lot of activists and economists in London. Some of them were actually working in the city that are ready to go.
Right. Boy, I tell you what, Tony, you've got it under control.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, George.
To a degree. Well, let's put it this way. You got a good handle on what's going
on. All the best, George.
Okay? We can't control.
No. I think the main thing, of course, is understanding what's going on, because that's the main job of the mainstream media at the moment, is to obfuscate, to dumb down, and to confuse us all. Once you can see what's going on, all of a sudden you can read the news. You can read between the lines on the TV news and the radio news. And that's what we aim to do here with our politics show on the radio here in Bristol, which, of course, is the port that discovered America. Supposedly. I mean, America, of course, is there all the time, you know.
Well, Tony, do you have any more
time? I've got to get going now, George, but thanks ever so much for having me on again.
Okay. Tony Godling from
Bristol.
All the
best, George.
Thank you very much. Good night. Thank you again, Tony. Boy, I tell you what, he comes in periodically with us from Bristol, England. Tony Godling has a lot on the ball, and we want to just thank him for that report from Bristol, England. There's a lot going on this week in this country. The last week and a half, I would say. And this Malaysian Flight 370 is still being searched for in the South Indian Ocean. You just heard Tony Godling. He doesn't think it's down there. He believes it was the sighting up at the Maldives Islands is a legitimate sighting. And so each to his own. I want to bring up John Cornyn just recently, came up with a very interesting objection to this new bill, and the new bill was being put forward by of all people, Schumer, Chuck Schumer. And the bill is very, very catchy and very, very tricky, and it's going to help us, you know, protect us when we have clients that we don't want to reveal. That's basically what it's all about. So are we going to do this? Anyway, Schumer's proposal would exempt what he describes in the bill as a covered journalist from subpoenas and other legal requirements to expose their confidential sources in leak investigations and other areas. Other lawmakers have proposed similar ideas in the past, but the effort gained new momentum after a series of revelations about controversial tactics the Justice Department was using to target journalists. Well, the problem with this, and Cornyn comes back and he says, look, this is licensing, beginning to license journalists and writers. And how about somebody out there that's writing on a very small blog somewhere? What about them? What do you do with them? So I'd have to come down on John Cornyn. It's one of the first things I've agreed with John Cornyn on. But this is something that I'm absolutely in agreement with him on. And he actually is standing up for a journalist in this situation. Recently, both Visa and MasterCard stopped servicing Russian banks. This is part of this blockade thing. And they had a monopoly for international operations. So they resumed operations later on, but in the meantime, the Russians have this payment system, Pro 100, and it's technically ready to provide natural processing in the near future. So what Visa and MasterCard are stepping out of, the Russians see an opportunity to come in and fulfill the domestic needs to clear credit transactions. So what one company does and misses out the boat on, and I think that they made a mistake by doing this, well, then someone else is going to come in and do it. We've seen the Ukraine just break open wide here, the Crimea takeover by the Russians with very little resistance. And then supposedly it started out there were 20 to 30,000 Russian troops that were doing exercises along the Ukrainian border. And now we're looking at maybe 100,000 troops. So that has been the latest troop buildup in the area, maybe 100,000. And I believe they're in different areas along the different borders of the Ukraine. So, but internally, when you start looking at the internal, you could say, parties of the Ukraine, you're going to get a hodgepodge. You need a little background here, and let me give you just a little background. When Barton Moorman, towards the end of the war, the Nazis finally realized that they were going to lose, and so they started bringing money out of Nazi Germany by way of Switzerland. And they also left Germany, and they made it out. There's even some theories that Adolf Hitler made it out also. A friend of mine's written a book and also produced a movie called Grey Wolf, based upon the successful flight of Adolf Hitler and his lady friend, Eva Braun, out of Berlin at the end of the war successfully and relocated to a place up in the mountains in Argentina. So what basically has happened is the Nazis collected up billions of dollars worth of investments, and since the end of World War II, they've invested in a number of international corporations. So now we have the former Nazis, and they don't go under that name anymore, but they're very wealthy, and they're very supported by other very, very wealthy individuals worldwide. That's why you're seeing a much more of a fascist turn of events. Whether you're talking about the outside forces of the Ukraine, the interior forces of the Ukraine, or even Russia itself, you're seeing much more of a fascist type of organization develop, especially from the outside and internally. The Ukraine no matter which faction internally was in control, some of those parties had former Nazi connections back to some very right-wing organizations in Germany today. So when you look at this, you have to go back and you have to say that many of the Nazis were brought into to America under the paperclip project, and they were supported here and they were nurtured here, and much of the money that they stole, the Nazis stole, was reinvested in many, some say up to 700 international corporations. So you've got these so-called ex-Nazis that are very wealthy, and they're worldwide investors besides. So that's what's really going on behind the scenes, is that we're seeing the elitist of the world restructure the world along a fascist, Nazi type of top-down organization. On the bottom, and I've said this before time and time again, they're providing us communism, see, a collective state, a socialism, communism, flavors of those too. And the reason why is that they can control the masses more easily through programs that they have to register for. The Obamacare is exactly the type of program that they're going to be beginning to control each and every American through. And that's why I've stood against it. I'm for medical care, but when you characterize it and set it up like they did, it's very dangerous to increase the control of the federal government over each and every American. So this is what is going on from the top down. You see the worldwide so-called New World Order elitist organizing along a corporate fascist type of formation, you could say. And then at the bottom, they're nurturing and they're behind many of these communist socialist groups. You see time and time again, whether it's the weathermen that came out of the SDS program during the Vietnam era, or you're seeing previous to that, early on in the 20th century, you had socialist movements and communist movements in America. A manifestation of this would be the Fabian Society in the late 1880s in England, which effectively has brought a very, very strong socialist government and system to England. The problem today exists that they don't have the viable economy to support and fund all the social programs that they were making available to the average English British citizen. So with that said, then you're beginning to look at this Ukrainian thing in a little bit different light. You've got factions in there that are very, you could say, fascist type in mentality and political bend. And then they are fighting other units in there, or other factions in there, with very similar types of views. The corruption level within the Ukraine is very high, no matter which recently dominating political figure that you had, or the recently figure that fled Kiev. I believe, and what I see on the street and what we saw before the sniper attack on the crowd, we saw some very, very well-intentioned Ukrainians that are yearning for freedom, real freedom. And that's the reason why we didn't see looting and things like that go on during that, chaos there and that mass protest movement that occurred in Kiev. So the units that went in there were connected to some of these very, very right-wing fascist groups. And so, and we did the shooting. And they turned this thing around and were able to portray the existing government as the culprits of this sniper attack on the crowd in general. But I believe they were shooting the sniper, were shooting both crowd activists in the crowd, and they were both also shooting some police. So they tried to make it look like, that the conflict was between the protesters, and the protesters were killing police, and the police were killing the protesters to cover their actions. In addition, we're seeing not only Russia take a very aggressive stance here, but Obama is being criticized for very little real action here and really stand up. I know Ted Cruz and these people like that are criticizing Obama's stance against Russia. There'd been this boycott there that they're beginning to form, an economic boycott, and that could be very effective against Russia. There are talks also of coming in and providing a liquid natural gas to Western Europe, and thus supplanting that gas supply or interrupting that gas supply from the Soviet Union to Western Europe. And I believe the Germans have a big stake in the receiving that natural gas. Just a tidbit here of information is that this liquid natural gas, these tankers are being set up and funded. And one of the largest companies involved in that is the Suez Company. And the Suez Company is out of Belgium. And they originally, along with British interest, owned the Suez Canal. Now, when Nasser came in and started taking and nationalizing the Suez Canal, boy, you had a big, big English and French, because it was English and French, investors that dominated ownership. And then you had Israel coming in there on the side of those British and French interests. And then Eisenhower said, nuh-uh, you're not going to do this. You're not going to invade Egypt. And effectively, his actions and so forth kept the Suez Canal in the hands of the Egyptians. And so Nasser was victorious during that stage and that era. In Egypt today, to understand Egypt, you have to see that the military there, the armed forces, and this Sisi guy, this General Sisi, who's going to just recently resigned, and he's going to be the new president, possibly, run for president. But what the armed forces, especially centered around the army, after they struck peace with the Palestinians, the PLO, which was very, very unpopular with the Israelis and so forth, then they took the army under Anwar Sadat and started organizing around industrial endeavors. So today, the Egyptian armed forces and the army, including in all of this, they dominate about 25% to 40% of the economy. Now, that's important to know, because everyone's talking about all of these democratic movements and the, you know, Muslim Brotherhood and all this other stuff. But since the armed forces dominates the majority of, as far as a single entity, the major part of the Egyptian economy, then they always come in there on the side of the people, and boy, we're going to help the people gain their freedom and democracy, but they're not going to really give democracy and freedom totally to the Egyptian people. Otherwise, they'd go in, the people of Egypt would go in and kick the army out of those business interests. They have an allocation system. They've got it all set up in the armed forces over there, and they're not going to give up those business interests. Nasser, originally, when he came in the 50s and started consolidating his leadership and dominance of Egypt, it was a military dictatorship, you could say, or a benevolent one under Nasser, and then they had elections later. But the military has always dominated Egypt. It still dominates Egypt, and they have close ties with the Pentagon because they're receiving aid from the Pentagon. So you begin to see those connections. You begin to see what's really going on. Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey recently, was ousted, a scandalous interception, I guess, or clandestine recording of a conversation of some of his top generals and leaders there, and they were out trying to plan, you know, some kind of a false flag operation that could blame the Syrians so that they could go in and attack Syria. But evidently this thing outed it, and that hasn't occurred yet. But what is going on within Turkey itself is that and this is where we have to draw a parallel. We have to use the word NATO secret armies. Professor Gassner out of Switzerland has pioneered in this area. He's written a book called NATO Secret Armies. But not only do we have some kind of false flag operations occurring within Ukrainian that could be labeled NATO Gladio type of operations to create tension and to get the people riled up and you know, to oust that previous president. But also, we're seeing this occur, and it has occurred for decades in Turkey. Now, Erdogan is evidently playing into the same dynamics that his predecessors did for ever since the ending of World War II. Those NATO secret armies were originally going to be what they call left behind. Irregulars, you know, guerrilla type of units. And then they took those and turned them in to false flag operations within those NATO countries to create tension. The name Gladio comes from Italy, which they uncovered them down there in a big investigation. And I think the word Gladio means sword. So when you hear a Gladio type of operation, it's loosely defined or means a NATO secret army operation. Now, we have the Ukraine that is not part of NATO yet. The European Union had been courting the Ukraine because it's a very wealthy country. But if you take a map also of all the gas lines and all the oil lines and stuff that are coursing through the Ukraine, you're going to see that the Soviet Union considers that an energy security nexus, you could say, for the Russian Federation. They're not going to relinquish the Ukraine under any circumstances, and they're certainly not going to relinquish it to European Union, much less NATO. I believe that the wish to recruit the Ukraine into the NATO and into the European Union, it's possible that they could have joined because of economic ties and maintained certain trade ties with the European Union, but Russia would never allow the Ukraine to be part of NATO, period. It's just too much of an intrusion into Russia proper, see. It's not the old Russia, but it's just too close. It's right there, at their doorstep. And also the Black Sea is right south of there. Now, they have Crimea back. And so Obama and those people met in The Hague recently, and they were playing war games. Well, let me make a few comments about these war games, okay? Is that the war games being played out in front of other national leaders, I believe, was not very wise to do. Each side, and we were doing this when I was in Berlin, was that we were trying to help get profiles on the Soviet leadership at the time. And the Soviets and the KGB and all their intelligence people were trying to get profiles on our top leadership. So in case of a confrontation like Kennedy had with Khrushchev on Cuba, you'd be wiser in making decisions on how to confront your adversary and his personality. See, you might know how far to push your adversary and in a very, very major conflict, and then you could always manipulate. If you knew enough about his personality type, you could always manipulate that personality to make a decision which would be favorable to you. When you're sitting down at a table with all these international leaders, and it's a security, nuclear security type conference or summit, they called it, and you start playing games, are you kidding me? That is revealing the personalities and what they would do under certain circumstances. I think it was a mistake to even try to get involved into anything like that. And it's certainly not wise to reveal what the President of the United States might do under a certain circumstance. Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, she was unhappy about trying to be drawn into this playing of these security games or whatever they put forward there at that summit. Later today, I believe President Obama, arrived in Saudi Arabia. Now, what Saudi Arabia has been doing here lately is what I guess in the oil industry they call a step-out well drilling, which is like a wildcat. You go outside the known oil field, and you might discover some new part of that oil field or an extension of that oil field, but you're taking a big risk. I think the Saudis right now are taking a very, very major risk, and I don't think they're going to win on this risk-taking. They're alienating many of the other leaders of the Arab world, and I just don't think that they're this foray into Syria is going to be beneficial to them. And it recently revealed now that those chemical attacks were carried out by the rebels in Syria. The Syrian army doesn't even have a rocket that can propel that chemical stuff over 2 miles, and they were much further removed from those areas that got attacked than that. Even the UN has stated that. That was recently released by a UN investigator. So we're talking about factual stuff here that's coming out, but it was a big propaganda push for that when it first was revealed. Getting back to this Malaysian flight, that is still very interesting. They are still searching the South Indian Ocean. I believe they've relocated their search activities further to the northeast, which would place it much closer to the western shore coast of Australia. That Indian Ocean is very treacherous. It's very big, and there's a lot of trash. I think one of the ideas that I see, or one of the things that I've seen that come up here, is that there's a lot of trash out there. My gosh. And Ebersmeyer, and also, I can't think of his name. He wrote Ocean, Plastic Ocean. I'll think of his name in a second. But they reveal that North Pacific around Hawaii like that has all kinds of trash in it and a lot of plastic, see? And so, as a result, there's a lot of trash out there that these satellites are picking up, but it's not really getting them anywhere or resolving any of the issues about where that plane actually went down. Now, earlier in this first hour, live from England, Bristol, England, this Saturday night, Tony Gosling seems to think that there was a sighting, a legitimate one, at the Maldives and the Maldives Island, and people saw the tail number or saw the markings on the plane, but it was more than one person. So that plane could be up there in that area somewhere or on the Asian mainland. Lyndon LaRouche, of all people, is stating that plane is on the Asian mainland, okay? He stated that recently on a talk show. I believe it was about Wednesday night or so. And so that's what he believes. Now, he has a lot of contacts, so you can't discount what he says entirely. And he does have contacts in an intelligence gathering operation. So what he's saying would have some validity or some factual facts to back it up in some way. Right now, we don't know for sure, and it remains to be seen. The other thing is that there was a stress test recently, okay? And there were 5 banks that were labeled by our Federal Reserve System as being, failing the stress test. And the biggest bank was Citigroup. And, boy, that's a big one. And then it ticked off several of the others, Royal Bank. These were American types of units operating. They were foreign banks, but American units. I seen Santander was another one, and I believe Royal Bank of Scotland was the third. There's Zion Bank was a fourth one. I forget the fifth one. But what they also, if you read down in, okay, the actual report that the Federal Reserve issued, you'll see that there was a notation about Goldman Sachs, and it implied and inferred and so forth very strongly that Goldman Sachs did not pass the stress test but made certain changes, structural changes, they said, or something like that, to comply, so they did pass the stress test. But Goldman Sachs evidently has major problems, and they came close to failing the stress test. What's happening in the banking sector is that the biggest dogs out there on the block, the biggest fish, the biggest sharks are going to take over many of these smaller banks. So they're promulgating and putting forward these stress tests under the guise that these banks were not liquid enough and so forth under this financial crisis. We did not have an economic crisis. We had a financial crisis, which was being portrayed at the time as being an economic crisis so that they could get the funding to continue to keep certain of their financial institutions liquid. And these are some of the biggest players in the world, see. So what we're going to see in the future is some kind of a write-down of the dollar, and no one exactly knows how it's going to come off. But what has to happen, or what will happen, is the average investor, individual, citizen in the West, so to speak, is going to lose some of their wealth. They're going to reorder the dollar in a downward way and so forth. I wanted to make a few comments before. We want to thank you for supporting us and listening to our broadcast. We just concluded last Sunday evening at 7. I want to thank Dr. Apsley, John Apsley from Washington State, and David Urth and Steve Hines. Well, what's going to occur on this next hour is that Colin Diggs, who is one of our associate producers of our Fukushima Solutions World Conference, is going to introduce Dr. John Apsley, who in turn will introduce Dr. Steve Hines. And the subject tonight during the second hour is going to be cancer. And boy, I tell you what, they have it down pat, and it's very intriguing on what they have to say. And I just hope you hold on there and listen to this second hour. These doctors are practicing integrative, regenerative, you could say alternative types of medicine. But the medicine that they are practicing is actually solving and curing people of some of the worst diseases, including cancer. And they were saying today that Dr. Hines, during the conference, and we're going to be playing that the second hour, that even root canals can give rise to many of the Parkinson's type diseases that manifest that way, and then they've taken that and reworked those root canals and did away with that infection, and before you knew it, the Parkinson's symptoms went away. So there's a lot to do. There are certain toxics that enter into your blood system that can turn on genes, and they can turn off genes. They can turn off genes that are sometimes very protective of cancer and so forth, and then that gives rise to you being susceptible to a cancer attack. But anyway, these doctors are on the leading edge. I hope you listen very carefully. We want to thank Tony Gosling again, and we want to thank Farrell Montgomery for helping render some of this production tonight. Thank you, Farrell Montgomery. And also, thank you very much for listening, and we're going to be signing off in just a few minutes here, and then you can go ahead and take it on in to the second hour. We'll have an announcement again at the top of the hour. And a beginning again of Sherry Fouché's song, Smack Dab in the Middle. And Sherry Fouché, thank you for writing that wonderful song for us and allowing us to use it as our introduction. And then we end every hour with a song that I wrote, Light a Little Candle. We sang that at the conference Sunday evening, and I want to thank Shay and Yoshimi and all those other people that helped put that together. Thank you, and good night.